this will give you your chance to test my volumes and see if my volumes are okay.
Yeah.
I'll try not to bump the thing so that I won't create odd little clicks and clacks. Thanks for coming today, by the way. That's just getting me warmed up there. You know, we just made that. We had the space, and so we thought, oh, well, you know, why don't we just do a little thing? And we didn't realize the cafe was actually going to be closed. So that was fun. But
restaurants closed.
Right.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So. Well, thanks for coming in to be here at KSDK. How has your Southeast trip been going so far?
Well, this is actually the third Southeast trip. During this campaign, which, you know, I started actively campaigning in October. I filed in August, but actively campaigning in October. And this one's gone gangbusters. I was in Sitka on Friday. We had a full packed day ending with an event at the end of the day that really brought a lot of people into a local business there, Salt. And we're just continue to meet new people and see people getting excited about the campaign. From there, we spent a full day yesterday in Ketchikan, which included meeting with Ketchikan Indian folks and folks down in Saxman, but also, you know, we did a little event at a brewery there as well. And, you know, it's just neat to see people getting more and more interested, more and more excited. By the time we got on the plane to come here, people were taking buttons off of me and putting them on, which is, you know, for a candidate, that's what you want. And then arriving here, we were a little late. The plane was late, and we quickly got ourselves ready, jumped down to the very small community meeting that we had to start it out. But that was more of a, just a meet and greet and let people have a chance to meet me. And I'm glad you were there, and so I'm glad you came by.
Yeah, thank you. And, okay, so what's on your agenda here in Wrangell? As you said, you were at the Stick.
Well, we have, from there we go to, from here I should say, we're going to meet with the tribe and with, I think, representatives of the, are we meeting with others at the tribe there?
Well, the A and B.
Oh, yeah, A and B, yeah, sure. Yeah, so it'll be meeting with some of your Alaska Native community. From there, we're going to do a spontaneous tour of some of your incubation of salmon. That's going to happen, and that's something I worked on when I was in the Senate, and I was surprised to find that it had actually gotten some traction here. And that's basically using indigenous practices to ensure that we have healthy genetic stock for salmon. That's a good thing. And then from there, we have a community meeting a little bit later today. And where's that going to be?
It's a smaller group. It's a smaller group at the Marine Bar.
At the Marine Bar. So what you're hearing in the background is I have my Southeast coordinator, Royal Henderson, is with me. And this is something you learn in a campaign statewide that you don't know when you're running just in a local campaign, is that your schedule belongs to someone else and you go where you're told. And I get to direct that I want to go to Southeast, but they get to tell me exactly when, where, and how I do it. So it's fun. It's good. And it's important.
Yeah, and so after here, you're going to Petersburg.
Yes.
And then Juneau.
Yeah, then it'll be in Juneau the following day. So Petersburg tomorrow, and then Juneau the following day, and then late night flight, I'll go back to Anchorage for the first time in a while, and then be there for a few days before I set out again. I've got, I have Fairbanks and Kodiak on the list coming up, and I've been to Bethel a couple of times in the interior. Got Seward, that's right, on April Fool's Day. We got a big event in Seward. Going to drive down for that. You know, the thing about campaigning in Alaska is if you're not going everywhere, you're not going anywhere. You really have to be all over the state. People expect it. We know our governors here, and people, I think, fairly demand that you come and be present. I don't know how many folks have been to Wrangell so far, but I have been, and I'll be back.
That was actually going to be my very last question.
Are you coming back? Yes, I'm coming back.
Okay, just about that salmon incubation that's in the school?
No, it's a private project that one of the gentlemen that was there today has been working on.
Brian.
Yeah, Brian. Yes. And this really, you know, back many, many years ago, we began to see a change in the genetic strength of our salmon stock. And that actually impacts their ability to survive in open water before they come back to spawn. And then working with Tom Harris and others that are from the indigenous community as far south as Saxman and Klukwan and also into South Central, we've been talking about what can we do to strengthen stocks. And looking back at traditional practices, which really, you know, allow a greater number of nutrients to get into your fry, which allows them to be healthier. And you can literally see the changes. And And that's what they're documenting now, the changes in the genetics that are strengthening the ability of those salmon to resist weather change and climate change. And those are things that we really have to be thinking about on a regular basis here now.
Yeah, great. Thank you. So no Democrat has won the Alaska governorship since, I believe, 98, right?
Tony Knowles was the last one. He got 51% of the vote in 98. Okay. And then there was a fusion ticket that, frankly, I helped put together, along with a number of other really good people. In 2014, that was Bill Walker as a nonpartisan and Byron Mallott as a Democrat. And the two of them did win lieutenant governor and lieutenant governor as a fusion ticket. So I'd suggest that that would be another option. That's another opportunity where it wasn't just a Republican governor, but it was people coming together around a ticket that included a Democrat.
Yeah. What's different about this race, and why do you think you can break that streak?
Oh, that's a good question. What's different about this race is we've had 7.5 years of the current administration. I think people are ready for a change. I think it's significant. Demographically, Alaska's been changing over the last few years. And while we still have a fairly strong Republican presence here, no Republican statewide candidate, even the president, have received more than 53 or 54% of the vote. So it's always been relatively balanced here. Mm-hmm. Even the last election, Governor Dunleavy won with just over 50% of the vote because he had a Democrat and Bill Walker both running in the race. So you had a 50-50 split, if you will, 51-49, basically. So it's a state that demographically is about balanced. And so number one. Number two, I have great working relationship around the state, not just with people of my party or nonpartisans, but also with a great number of Republicans. I earned that by being able and open to listen without ever having to sacrifice my convictions. And I think that's important. People say, this is a real broker, a person who listens to us. And to be fair, quite frankly, the data supports it, too. So demographically, I'm reasonably well-liked and well-known in the state, and that is helpful. And it, there's something to having spent 30 years working in rural communities on substance use prevention, violence prevention, suicide prevention, mental health issues, juvenile justice. These issues literally permeate our communities around the state. I've slept on gym floors in Western Alaska. I've even once been in a jail cell in Point Hope because that was the only bed available. But you stay where you have to stay, and you get to know people. And those relationships, I think, and most Alaskans do, but when you build a friendship here, 20 years can go by, but you're still going to be pretty close to that person. And I think I have those relationships. I think that's made a difference.
Yeah, thank you. And I know you were a senator, and you have all a history of political work. Obviously, this is a very simple question. Why are you running for governor?
Oh, that's usually the first question people ask. But there's a number of reasons. The first is I do deeply love my state. I was born here. I didn't run for public office until I was in my 50s, and because I really felt there were things that had slipped and fallen apart. Those included, wanting to ensure that we had a stronger education system, civility in how we worked with each other, and fairness in how we dealt with each other, both politically and personally. So those were things that drove me then. We really worked hard over the 6 years that I was in the Senate for as minority leader to build those cross-party relationships. And so not just within my caucus, but also with the majorities and the minorities in both bodies. And the reason why was if you could leave a legacy of civility, then things get done. As time has gone by since I left, which was in 2022, I've really watched those relationships between the governor and the legislature deteriorate. And I think that is bad for Alaska. And I've watched it impact Alaska. And I looked at the field that was currently running at the time, and I still feel this way, but I didn't see anybody there who had the capacity or ability in the long run to really, truly build those relationships again. But there are some good people running. Don't get me wrong. I'm not saying that. What I am saying is that I have the capacity to do that. And I think my willingness to change the dialogue, to look at pushing for that strong, forward, and fully funded education system, moving us away from a dependency on diesel fuel and moving toward alternatives in the state, is about looking forward, not just looking back. And it's about actually finding ways to sustain the state as independently as we can in the long run. for years we've been dependent on the federal government, and we know now with the volatility of the current presidential administration, that's just not going to be the future. Because of that, it's important for us to maximize our resources in terms of the permanent fund, ensuring that it not just survives but thrives, because it produces 60% of Alaska's income today. And we need to know that it will be healthy, hale, and able to produce eventually as much as 70 or 80% of our income. It means that we have to ensure that when we have multinational corporations coming into our state and taking our resources, that we get our fair share of those resources, because that's what we use to pay for our education, our ferry system, whether or not we're providing health care, whether or not we're ensuring that our road systems work. All of those depend on whether or not we're getting the resources we deserve. So those are the reasons why I'm in this race, because I think I'm best suited to do those things.
Yeah, great. And your nephew, Representative Nick Begich, is a Republican.
Mm-hmm.
How do you navigate campaigning in a state where your family name cuts both ways politically?
I make sure people know which one I am. That's for sure. I have a button that says Tom on it. That's number one. Number two is, our people are already differentiating. In the polling, people are clearly identifying him as different than me. I, quite frankly, am a little bit better liked in the state than he is, and that shows in the data. And I think that's fine. Where people are confused, I do my best to ensure that they understand I represent different values than he does, and I'm sure he does the same, because he has the same worry that maybe you think I have, but I'm pretty comfortable with it either way. Look, I grew up in a family where my brothers and sisters did not always agree, and my mom raised us, single mom. I mentioned that earlier today when you were at the cafe, and part of that upbringing was be patient, listen to others' perspectives, and then move forward. Well, I don't begrudge, a different perspective. My nephew has one. I don't vote for him. I mean, but he's still my nephew. I love him, but I'm not going to vote for him. But that said, there are things that we find in common. We talked earlier today about, the possibility of Rangel's position in terms of the national defense strategy. Well, that's something we have in common. We both know that makes sense, and we both think that's a possibility. So, you navigate it just like you would any rough family relationship, or you work around it, and you just remain respectful of each other. So,
yeah. And earlier today at the meet and greet, somebody asked about, Brian asked about what you wish would have happened during your time. But will you just talk about your successes?
Yes. He really focused on he asked me the question about what I hadn't, if I had a regret effectively. And it was really that I want to actually answer that question before I go to the successes. But the regret was that we didn't do enough to stabilize the permanent fund itself, because that is the renewable resource capital, and that is the future of Alaska. We did put $9 billion into it, though, into the principal, which cannot be touched. And I think that was extraordinarily important. But the thing that was perhaps the biggest success for me was the Reeds Act. Now, the Reeds Act was a bill that is now rolling pre-kindergarten into our base student allocation. So we won't be a K-12 state. We'll be one of the few states that's a pre-K-12 state. And that's really important, because we know when you bring a kid to school ready to learn, which is what strong pre-K does, and you back it up with a strong reading program, which the Reeds Act also provided, by fourth grade, you're holding on to the gains that you made, and those kids are performing better and better. And we know that that's happening. The North Slope Borough reported on that just 2 weeks ago. LKSD, Galena, Petersburg, Fairbanks School Board has told me that the results are 2 to 3 times their expectations for their kids that have been now under the Reeds Act for three and a half, four years. And so that, to me, is really, really important. That's a reform that we have worked on for years. The pre-K alone, we fought for over 35 years to get that into the base student allocation. That is a success. I took my name off the bill to ensure it would pass, because I was a minority member. But what I did do is I went and testified in the 60-plus hearings, either myself or my staff, went to the House and the Senate and testified at every hearing on that bill to make sure that that bill passed the legislature. Unanimous in the Senate, 21-19 in the House, but it became law with the governor's signature.
Yeah, yeah. And actually, my next question was about the Alaska Reads Act.
Okay.
So, you said the key is finding the fundamental thing you care about most and aiming for common ground. Mm-hmm. Can you give voters a specific issue where you'd be willing to compromise in ways that might disappoint your own party?
Well, that bill did. You know, it disappointed them because they saw me working with the governor, and it was really a belief of a number of the members of the majority in the House, who are mostly Democrats and independents, that that was not an acceptable thing to do, and I disagree. Look, I never had to compromise my values when it came to what I voted for. With that bill in particular, when I got together with the Commissioner of Education and the governor, we laid out ground rules, and those ground rules were no trigger words for Democrats, no trigger words for Republicans. Talk about the science, talk about the outcomes, look at the evidence, and any change to that bill that we make, we all had to agree on. Mm-hmm. That builds a stronger bill. It doesn't build a weaker bill. There were questions in the House initially. They were focused on, well, we need to ensure that there's more cultural competence in the bill. So we added that all to the final version of that bill. But some members of the House didn't even bother to look at that final version of the bill. They just voted no because it was an agreement which the governor had indicated he would sign. So I get it. You know, some people don't like a guy and they feel like they have to do that. But we're not there to care about whether or not we like each other. We're there to actually do the business of the people. And what that bill did is it transformed education for kids who didn't have real access to pre-K. It transformed their ability to learn, and we're seeing the evidence of that today. So, there are three Democrats in this race. I was the only one who voted for that bill. The other two voted against it. And so sometimes your party doesn't agree with you, but you have to identify what is the right thing to do for Alaska. Tell you where we failed there, we didn't fully fund it. And that needs to happen. And that is where I and my colleagues, my other Democrats who are in this race, agree. We have to forward fund and fully fund education. And if we don't do that, and when we say forward fund, that means giving school districts an opportunity to know what their budget is sooner than 2 weeks before their fiscal year starts so they don't have to pink slip teachers. It creates instability. It's bad for kids. But if you fully fund the Reads Act, you're going to see those outcomes across the state in both our best performing and our poorest performing districts. And that, to me, is the biggest win you could possibly have. In the end, nobody's attacking that bill today. And they don't because they know it's successful. And so I embrace my former colleagues who opposed it. I wish that they would then take it to the next level. Some of them are now. And move forward with the next. What's the next level? It's math and science. Is ensuring those are fully covered. It's ensuring that we are doing our constitutional obligation to provide arts education to kids. Why? Because it expands the mind and allows you to be a better citizen. Civics education passed recently in the Senate. We're hoping that that will pass the legislature and be signed into law. These are things that will actually make strong citizens, citizens who are engaged and involved, kids who are successful, can move on to college or vocational education or just be successful in their own community. Those are things that matter to me. Sometimes people don't vote with you. That's okay.
Yeah. And since we're on education right now, what's your specific plan to resolve the long-running standoff of education in Juneau? And what are you willing to give up to get there?
The point of always having to give up something to get there is what I call a false negotiation. The real issue is, do we have the money to fund a solid education system? And we're often told we don't. What we actually do have is the resources there. We just do not collect them. I've mentioned this before. All across the state, there's the internet fee that was tied to education for $35 million that literally was vetoed by the governor, and the legislature did not override that veto. But if I'm governor, I'll be signing that bill into law the day it comes on my desk. That's $35 million in reoccurring revenue that we are not collecting today that we could be. I will sign into law the exception that has allowed Hillcorp not to pay oil corporate income tax on its oil properties. They're the only oil company that does that because of a loophole in the law. That loophole should be closed so that we do not further risk losing corporate income tax and that we collect that $100 to $150 million. And finally, I have advocated for, and the Senate Resources has now adopted, an approach that would reduce the oil and gas tax credits on the three largest oil fields on the North Slope, Prudhoe, Alpine, and Kuparuk. Those would generate, in my estimate, between $200 to $250 million. In the Senate Resources Committee's estimate, $400 to $450 million. So I'm going to go with the lower number. That's $500 million. It's more than enough to resolve the education issue and put money in the bank.
Yeah, and that's part of your fiscal plan.
That is my fiscal
plan. That is your fiscal
plan. Yeah, well, I mean, there's other pieces as well, ensuring we use carbon credits appropriately so that that would actually kickstart revenue sharing again, which we should be doing for local municipalities. There are a number of other ideas that I've put on the table that I think are good ideas, and I'm open to really constructive and non-regressive ideas from anybody. If they have a good revenue idea, man, go to my website, TomBegichForAlaska.com, and let me know what your revenue ideas are. I'm open to them.
Let's talk about your carbon credit.
Yes.
Will you just go into that a little?
Sure. I love to call it my carbon credits. The truth is, it's not. It was a bill that passed after I was in, but it came from a bill that I wrote that rarely got a hearing. But what the carbon credits do is it allows us to sequester state-owned lands where you might have done timber harvesting, for example. And the value of the future harvest is determined for up to 50 years, and then you literally sell the value of that non-cutting to a company somewhere in the world that is trying to offset its own laws of where they're producing too much carbon. So they get a credit against the carbon they're producing, and we do it. We provide it by not cutting timber. So we make money not cutting timber, and the money is rather substantial. See, Alaska this year had identified, I think it was about 117,000 acres, and they literally, and this was a headline in a Juneau paper, they literally made $100 million from doing that. So they literally go onto a market, it's a marketplace, and we're all set up for it, by the way. Alaska's set up for it right now. We've done all the work. We just haven't actually done any sales. I would absolutely aggressively pursue those because you could take a small town that maybe had relied on timber in the past, but where the markets aren't there anymore because people are undercutting the price of timber, and you could take the same people, the same 10 or 12 that were working in that mill and say, look, here's what we're going to do. We're going to do this carbon credit deal. We'll use some of that resource to help retrain you. Some of that resource will go directly to your community so that you can do other things with your community. You know, rebuild your community center if that's what you want to do. Help your clinic, you know, if that's what you want to do. And then we'll also put some of it in a general fund that operates to support these communities. It's a win-win. Everyone wins with that deal. And, you still have the carbon being produced, but not we're holding on to that to offset it. So the carbon credit bill is a really good idea. It was one backed by the Senate majority, Democrats and Republicans. It was backed by the governor. It was backed by me. I did some of that negotiating behind the scenes. And it was backed by the House. Both Republicans and Democrats backed it. So universally accepted bill.
Yeah. And what's interesting is right now, federally, there's a huge push for timber cuts in Alaska. I know the current governor supports that. The borough manager here supports that too, for timber cuts in this area, and of course the Tongass National Forest. So, what will your role be? Like, how will you?
Will I negotiate that?
Yes.
Well, when it comes to state lands, we have control. When it comes to federal lands, we don't. And the carbon credit bill wouldn't apply to the federal lands. I mean, it is state law, but those are federal lands. You can't stop. You can't stop a president of the United States from deciding to enact their policy on us unless you sue them. I'm not really interested in a bunch of lawsuits. But what I would ask the folks in the local communities would be, is it feasible? And if it is feasible, do you want it? And if you do want it, then let's do it. But I was talking to a guy who is reflecting on Whale Point on Prince of Wales, and he said here was a community that wanted to apply carbon credits to the state land around them. And the administration decided they wanted to, in fact, cut the timber, even though it would be sold below cost, and so there wouldn't be any profit made, but because timber cutting was important. they literally gave up the opportunity to have income coming into Whale Point, not because they wanted to, but because it was forced on them. And I don't think that's right. Now, if your community says that they want a timber cut, that's up to your community to determine. If you negotiate with the state and say you have state land here, university land, mental health land, or state land, and we would like to earn carbon credits from it, our job is to facilitate that. But if you don't want to and you want to cut it, even though you're cutting it for a loss, our job is to help you do what the community wants to do. My job as governor would be to say, is this really what you want to do when you could have 50 years of steady income that would potentially be this amount of money that you could use, invest, or do whatever you want with? Or do you want to do a one-time cut that gets you some money one time, but that doesn't, in the end, serve you because you have to wait till regrowth? It might affect your deer hunting. It might affect your habitat. It could affect your commercial fishing, depending on where you're doing the cut. You could end up with a lawsuit because entities in Southeast have sued cities and others in the state over cuts. So that negotiation, and two things, that negotiation has to happen with the governor taking an active role in it. But this federal administration won't be there forever. This president, unless we violate the Constitution, cannot be reelected. And with that in mind, I would want to work with any administration to ensure whatever policy is being applied to the forests that are within our state's boundaries is one that makes sense for our state's future. That's, look, my job as governor isn't to protect the federal government or some business. It's to protect the citizens of the state of Alaska. And where they're involved and active, I want to be supportive of them. But if I have to choose between a multinational corporation that wants to cut our timber for cost and write it off against their taxes, my answer is no. If they want to do something that actually enhances the community, my answer is yes. And if the community's there with them, let's do it together.
And that goes for alternative energy as well.
Oh, yes, absolutely. You know, I've talked about alternative energy a lot. We, in Western Alaska, the price for diesel fuel is set by contract, and that contract's usually one delivered in March and one delivered in the fall. So when you go to war the first week of March and the contracts kick up the price triple, that means that those schools that are buying diesel fuel have to buy it at the higher price. That's the contract deal. And so the barge brings it in, and now you've paid three times as much for diesel fuel, so you have to cut from your operating budget, which is where your energy comes from, which means you lose teachers. And so this math doesn't work for me, and it shouldn't work for any Alaskan. Our dependency on diesel fuel must be broken. And to do that, we have the opportunity and the resources where we could help retrofit homes for energy efficiency. We could be providing solar or other means, heat pump or other subsidies through grants and or low interest loans to individuals for their homes to make them energy efficient. We could be doing that for small businesses. We could do it for nonprofits, and we could do it for schools. We have the resources in the Alaska Industrial Development Export Authority alone to be able to do some of that work. And if we did with a Department of Energy, which I propose, that has a coherent plan, that's an energy plan from oil and gas all the way to alternative energies, we could also kickstart young people's interest in this state. Earlier today, you heard someone say, if we could do it here, we could do it anywhere. That gentleman who said that has tapped right into what I believe. This is the best testing ground for alternative energies in the world. It's a safe environment and a rough environment. If your battery storage isn't able to hold up here, it won't hold up anywhere. If you can develop other forms of storage for energy, this is the place to do it. If you want to find the best way to have solar be efficient, go to a place where it's dark two-thirds of the winter and figure out how to make it more efficient. This gives us an opportunity. And we have a green bank now, too, and that was something the governor and I agreed on. We literally have the capacity here to generate the capital to help attract people here to test those technologies, and we're doing it today. Some of that's happening today.
Yeah, awesome. Thank you. Okay, we're going to move on to the Alaska Marine Highway.
Yay!
Will you talk about your plan with that?
So I talk about it in three components. One is to set up a Alaska Marine Highway Authority so that once we won't go through the ever perennial governor after governor changing the plan, coming up with a new best idea that's decided by somebody who isn't necessarily interested or active within the system. I believe it should be a separate authority. Alaska Marine Highway Authority that also has the capacity to bond, and that is as a board that's selected by the communities the Marine Highway serves. I think that's critically important. You know, that number one, number two, ensuring the vessels that we produce and that those vessels are vessels that are interchangeable, that we don't keep changing the design so that we end up with using or having to contemplate dual docks and things like that. Part of that's also ensuring that we can access railheads. I've always talked about Prince Rupert in that regard, because when you're connected to a railhead, you lower price for groceries and supplies. That has dramatic impact on Southeast, but also South Central. It has an impact on both. There's talk about perhaps getting a railhead out of Canada right here to Wrangell. That fits the same platform that came up after I think you left, but that came up, and you know there are opportunities there as well. Second part of the plan. The third is to deal with the deferred maintenance that has been neglected for so long. I would do that with a general obligation bond. But here's the thing with the ferry service: you have to have known regular service. It's a highway system. It is not a luxury. It is a system that serves life and health issues for everyday Alaskans, and it is the connector for all the pieces of Highway 7. There is no Highway 7 without the ferry system. It is a highway, and it should be treated as a highway, not the stepchild of the Department of Transportation, which is what happens now. And the state has an obligation to provide regular service on a highway. You should be expecting that. It's not a profit-making operation. It's never going to be. I have no ever believe that it should be privatized. This is our system of transportation. An investment now to deal with deferred maintenance, coherent planning, all of that means that in the long run you spend significantly less money. But right now we triage after triage, we make it worse and worse, it's unpredictable. This is a disservice to the residents of not just Southeast, South Central, which relies on ferry service, and Cordova, and Valdez, and Seward, and Whittier. It's not just a disservice to them, also to Kodiak, and Homer, and to Dutch Harbor, all served by the Marine Highway System, but not served to the capacity they should be. That is doable, and it ought to be part of comprehensive planning in the state. You'll do that if you have a separate Marine Highway System where that is the priority, and again, not the stepchild of the Department of Transportation.
Yeah, absolutely. And earlier today, Jake mentioned the AMH, or no, sorry.
The Inland.
Yeah, Island IFA.
Sorry, Island IFA, right. Yes.
Yes. And so the docks here, have you had much time to think about that? Because as he mentioned earlier, it used to come here and service the communities surrounding here. Mm-hmm. And again, that feels like a disservice to us. What are your thoughts with that?
Well, you know, identifying, you're really getting at what we need to do in terms of collaboration, cooperation. That whole ferry service developed because of the insecurity of the actual Marine Highway System, its inability to serve, and the need to have regular service. And so I support that. I've ridden that ferry as recently as 2 weeks ago, you know, or not that ferry, there are more than one, but I've actually ridden that system down to Metlakatla just a couple of weeks ago. And what I can tell you is that it's efficiently run, it was timely, and it only serves Metlakatla once a day, but that's pretty good. You know, now the Marine Highway, by the way, is also going to serve Metlakatla once a day. So there's a duplication that's going to happen. I hope that they have schedules that they're coordinating so that one is going over, not at the same time as the other, so that they can actually create a service. What I would propose as governor is that you would take these services and you would ensure that they're at the table together, negotiating their schedules together so that they're literally feeding each other. And if that means that we see more service here or sharing of docks here, then let's do that. This cannot be competition between two effectively government services. It needs to be collaboration between two. They can serve each other and support each other in that process. I've seen that done in other places. I mentioned that earlier today in Scotland and British Columbia and Puget Sound. We know how to do it. Why we haven't done it here is a mystery to me, and that needs to be resolved. I think part of it really has to be a governor who says, this is important to me, and directs those folks to actually make it work, convenes those groups. The power of the governor is pretty profound in that regard, and you still have a governor who gets to veto or not veto deferred maintenance and fund or not fund elements of a ferry system. Even with an authority, there's going to be some negotiation between the two, just there is now with the mental health authority and the mental health budget that comes before the legislature and the governor. So with that in mind, a governor has to take an active role in ensuring that the system is planned and thoughtful. And there are plans that are good that have been written by task forces in the past. I'd love to have them vetted by the actual communities that are served to see if the replacement and repair schedule works, if the proposed ferry schedules work, if the proposed coverage works, and if not, how do we fix it? What do we need to do for other resources to make it work better? But it should serve Wrangell. It should serve Cake. It should serve Petersburg. It should serve Sitka. It should serve every community in Southeast, regardless of where that community is located, because that was our commitment at statehood.
Thank you. Speaking about vetoing, where do you stand with public media?
I'm not just a member of Coast Radio and KCAW specifically for many, many years, for over two decades, but also KYUK, Palmer Public Radio, which is a small independent, not related to the budget, KSKA, KNBA, there's others as well. I believe in public radio, and I believe in full funding of public radio. I've been disappointed that for the last 7 years and this year as well, that we're not going to see the full funding of public radio. I'm appalled by the choices made to dismantle the Corporation of Public Broadcasting. In Alaska, we have one of the highest listenerships per capita of any state in the union. And the reason we do is because in areas like here, there are few commercial options. And people rely on public radio to tell them what's happening, not just in the world, not just in the state, and not just in the local community, but when the weather goes awry, or when things put us at risk. Public radio is an essential service to Alaska. Whether it's COTS, KOTZ, or KNOM, these are stations I have gone to my entire life and watched the service that they have provided the communities that they serve. I, as governor, will always support public radio without hesitation.
Thank you. Now, housing. So housing is an issue.
Yes, all over the state. And, yeah. You know, it wasn't originally, when I first started campaigning, I didn't put it on my agenda as a thing I would hear about. And the very first meeting was in Homer. And it was a young person who stood up, Theo, and he's like, you know, this is our problem. None of us can ever live in housing. So that has come up in every single community I've been to. And we have begun to really think through some really creative solutions that have emerged from these community conversations. So here's one idea I've sort of put out there based on all of this conversation. It's the state owns massive holdings within communities. Mental health trust land I mentioned earlier, University of Alaska land, state land. We have these properties that we hold. In Sitka, they took 17 acres of mental health trust land. They worked with the homeless coalition, and they ended up building 24 housing units. Now, that was good for construction industry there. It's permanent housing. It's not temporary housing. So it's permanent housing for a homeless population. I went back. I saw them under construction. I went back 2 days ago and looked at it and saw bikes and art and other things in these structures already. I'd been there in October, and they hadn't been finished yet. So you're literally seeing people housed today affordably. Now, the state could do more of that. They could work with communities and say, Ketchikan, you have a housing shortage right now, and the state has all this land. Land is one of the major costs of new housing. So let's figure out a way to provide our land next to cost and provide it so that new development can be built that's affordable development, so put some conditions on it. Help spur the industry by lowering low-interest loans to help spur the construction of that housing. Providing the money I talked about earlier from ADA, using that resource to ensure that it's highly efficient, energy-efficient housing, something most people can't afford. But you could actually get somebody into a highly energy-efficient home at cost. we've talked about a great idea that came out of Juno was nonprofits working as a consortia. And so you build that same kind of housing and you make it available to young people who want who they can't hire because they can't house them. And so you get young people who go into this housing that's permanent housing as long as they work within one nonprofit, with one of the nonprofits in the consortia. So let's say I come to work for public radio. I don't like my manager, so I decide I want to go work for Search, and they're part of the consortia, so I don't have to give up my housing. And so it's a collaborative that serves both entry-level and younger populations coming to Alaska because it's affordable. And if you tie that to a fairly basic expansion of Denali KidCare, call it Denali Care, and provide for folks a basic safety net for health insurance, you've just resolved your problem for recruiting people to Alaska who are younger because you're providing a basic health care, providing inexpensive housing, and you're doing it using state collaboration with communities. We have given away assets in the past with no clear direction. Ada built a $2 million+ fish processing facility in Anchorage, and we gave it to a church for $1 because no one ever used it. What about actually with a deliberate plan, working with communities and saying, we have these assets, what is your plan for comprehensive housing? Can we do it together? You just have to drive that vision. But imagine that for a second. Housing that's affordable. Housing where you're not limited because you're trapped by state land. That state land is an asset that allows you to actually build more housing. I think that's good for the construction industry. It's good for the state. It's good for mental health. Housing is an imperative for mental health. It's good for your homeless population if you do a project like the Homeless Coalition in Sitka. But more importantly, it's good for young people in Alaska because it will keep them here and it will attract them here. And if you're doing that while you're building new industry with encouraging alternative energy industries up here, you'll get the best and the brightest. Strong education system, housing that's affordable, a medical care that you know is present even at the base level, and the ability to be working in a cutting edge field. Yeah. To me, that is what Alaska ought to be.
Yeah, definitely. And yeah, so Wrangell has a 1% growth rate for over the past year, but it has been diminishing before, mm-hmm. You know?
I do.
And so that also leads into with the housing, your answer with housing that increases jobs. Do you have any other ideas on keeping people here or trying to inspire people to move here?
Well, the idea that you would become the cutting edge for what is going to be the future, of most of the world, being cutting edge in that industry, I think is a primary attractor. I do believe that we can enhance our vocational education up here so that it makes it more attractive. I've talked about, we'll never have a medical school up here because it's too expensive to build it with all the facilities, but we should have a stronger residency program so that you're getting people into communities that have large clinics or small hospitals and ensuring that we have a known and high-quality residency program. So you're bringing up young people who want the adventure of Alaska, who know that if they get married here or they want to raise a family here, that there's a good education system. So that attracts them here because we have all the other assets. We're one of the most beautiful places in the world, if not the most beautiful place in the world. And so that alone is the first attractor. It also means, though, that if you are going to bring people into entry-level jobs here, say in public service, that they have a defined benefit, that they have a pension plan. Because there is clear evidence that we lose young professionals from our state service and our teachers because we only offer what's called effectively a 401k. And so after 5 years, at the height of their skills and abilities, they go find a pension plan somewhere because they want to raise a family. We should be providing one, too. We have in the past. We can in the future. And it's a debate right now in the legislature. I suspect the governor will veto whatever final bill comes out. He may not, but I suspect he will. And if he does, they'll have vetted it. When they bring it back in front of me in January and February, I'll sign it into law. But if you do those things, you'll begin to enhance your economy and the jobs that it creates. If you have a healthy education system and you're getting your full fair share of resources, that means you can repair schools. You can actually use major maintenance budgets to find jobs, basically that produces jobs because somebody has to do that work. Today, 24% of our workforce doesn't even live here. I want to ensure that our workforce feels a desire to live here, that we hire Alaskan more than we have been in the past, and that we encourage anyone who wants to use our resources, not just encourage them, but require them to hire Alaskans. And we don't do that well. We have done a poor job of that. We used to talk about Alaska Hire up here all the time, and now it's just kind of like, please, please take our resources. And I know that your guys are all going to be flying in and out on Alaska Airlines, but please take our resources. I have a different attitude. I'm glad that you want our resources, but can you at least do something more than just giving us 10 grand for some social benefit and thinking that's good enough? We're giving you billions of dollars. The least you can do is hire Alaskans to do the work.
Yeah. What's your position on the permanent fund dividend, and how large should it be, and how should the state balance the PFD against services?
Well, if you do the fiscal plan I laid out before, there is no balancing of a PFD against services. You're providing services, and you should be able to provide a dividend. Now, how big should that dividend be? There is nobody that I'm aware of that is a serious candidate that thinks that the dividend can stay with the current statutory formula. And I believe that as well. I think you have to rewrite the statute. And I think you should rewrite the statute so that the check itself is tied to the volatility of the permanent fund itself. What I mean by that is if the permanent fund is making money, then that check goes up from an initial amount that you started at. If it loses money, it goes down. And you could use a one-year average, a one-year response or a three-year average, somewhere in that range. I leave that to the legislature to decide because, you know, they'll bring the experts, there'll be testimony that'll, you know, people will testify on to what the best process is. But right now it's based on a five-year rolling average, that statute. It's a set amount that is a percentage of the earnings, which means that we get three good years and then two bad years. We're way over our skis. We're in a position where we simply can't afford the check, and that's what we've been facing for the last 10 years. So Governor Walker made a move to arbitrarily cut the dividend and without real thought behind it. And what that problem with that is that you have to resist that kind of arbitrary change. You have to actually negotiate what that change is. So now for the last, outside of 1 year, for the last 8 years, we've had about a $1,000, $1,500 dividend. I'd say tell the legislature, and I just answered this question for somebody, by the way, in a publication, but just the way I would do it is say, all right, somewhere between $1,000 and $1,500, set that as the starting point, and then let's make it a new statute that we can abide by instead of constantly ignoring our own statutes. Let's make it real, and then let's let it grow. So if the permanent fund gets to $120 billion, that check will be larger. But it's okay because you've built the permanent fund alongside it, you see, so that at no point does the amount of a dividend outstrip your ability to pay it. Right now, it constantly outstrips our ability to pay it because we haven't stabilized the fund itself. So what I'm proposing is you do a statutory change. You let the legislature set that amount somewhere in that range, and then you continue to invest in the permanent fund, getting it larger and larger, hoping that the investments pay off. And then in the end, you're able to maintain a dividend that is an appropriate dividend that we can afford while providing public services. You only get to those public services if you're also collecting the revenue I identified earlier, in particular from the oil industry.
Great. You're about to meet the Wrangell Cooperative Association, I believe, right? Can you talk about your support for Native corporations, your work with Native corporations, and also the Wrangell Cooperative Association is part of the Landless Five mm-hmm. as well. Will you talk about where you stand with that?
Well, you said corporations, and I want to just be clear. My support for Indigenous people begins at the tribal level, and it's a little bit different. Now, the corporations were set up by ANCSA. My father was the author of ANCSA in Congress, and the corporate structure was the structure that was devised, both village corporations and regional corporations, to ensure that the bill would pass. And that bill granted, 40 million acres for some tribes, not all, as you point out. And it also granted a substantial amount of money, which basically capitalized the corporations. that bill was always intended to be a starting point, not an ending point. So fast forward to where we are today, where we have village corporations, we have regional corporations, we have recognized tribal governments, and in some villages we also have civil government in those villages, and that is separate from a governance. Like in Wrangell, you have a city council, but in Kotlik, you have a city government, and you have three tribal organizations, and you have the village corp. So that collaboration, cooperation between all five has to happen. One thing that would help resolve this is if we actually gave full recognition to tribes, which I do believe is overdue. The federal government has done it. We have not done it at the local level. I believe that has to happen, and I believe we should be treating our tribal partners as partners, not as somehow subservient to the state. We should be doing it collaboratively. I think we're going to be stronger if we do that. It's going to create less animosity and build stronger relationships across the board. That's what I'll be talking with the Wrangell group about today, because that matters to me, and I've said it everywhere that I've been. You know, there's one candidate in this race who actually, you know, pushed very hard for to be state recognized tribal languages. That's a good first step. That's a great first step. There are others in this race that have talked about tribal compacting as a critical component for how we develop a stronger education system. It's also a good step. But we have to do all of this in a collaborative manner and then put real force behind it. And so I take a radically different position than most of the people running by saying these things, but I think it's time for us to recognize who our friends and neighbors are and treat them that way. I would expect no less from them than I think that they should expect from me.
Yeah. And then I've written quite a few articles about transboundary mining issues. Mm-hmm. And I know the tribe here, you know, it's an issue. It affects salmon, all of that. How would you work with Canada with that?
Well, it's difficult. You know, you have to work with Canada, not just on mining issues, but you have to work with Canada on all the comprehensive natural resource issues, because the Stikeen, you know, starts in Canada and works its way down here to Wrangell. It has to be managed both for its resource potential in terms of fish resource and its not just commercial but subsistence resource, but we also have to recognize that there are mining interests there. And so my way of approaching mining across the state has been very basic. We have some operations that are doing really well. You know, they are collaborative. Before I go to transboundary completely, but they're collaborative. They work with their local communities. They hire locally, and they have out-of-state residents working there too. But like Kensington is an example of that in Southeast, Greens Creek. These are mines that have good community-based relations generally and have generally done a very good job of being good partners. And the communities generally support those mines. So my priority is, if the community wants the development, let's sit down with the community and make sure they're at the table and that they get the development that is clean and safe and hires Alaskans that they want. If they oppose that development, and I'm going to point to Cascade Point on this one. This is up by Juneau. There's two mines that they're speculatively talking about, and they're going to take road money and build a ferry terminal in a place that doesn't serve people but will serve these mining interests. It's opposed by 90% plus of those who've testified. That's a project that should not happen. And as a governor, I would not let that happen. Oh, but it's economic development, is it? Because it's really two multinational corporations. In this case, I think one's Canadian. And it's likely not to employ Alaskans. It's going to use up money that we could have used to improve ferry service, for sure. And it's going to make ferry service that much more difficult for walk-on passengers. So none of it makes sense. It literally does not make sense for Alaskans. I've had people call me and go, oh, you've got to support this. This is development. I go, it doesn't serve but maybe 10 people or 15 people who make some money off of it. That is not my job. My job, you know, you want to build that terminal? Build it. I'll work with you to come up with, you know, maybe I'll give you a tax exemption for 10 years, but you build the terminal. Don't use our money to build the terminal. You know, and if it is such an economic boom, in exchange for that tax break, you're going to hire Alaskans. And that'll be good. And then whether it's Gold Belt Corporation or whomever, they're going to have a chance to take advantage of that in a way that doesn't harm Alaskans, but in a way that helps. But going back to transboundary issues, whether it's fishing, timber, mining, or quite frankly, whether or not we do or don't build roads or railroad that might, in fact, railhead right here, you know, near Wrangell. These things require us to have a collaborative relationship with British Columbia and the Yukon Territory, and quite frankly, also Alberta, because they're a competitor in the oil and gas industry, and they will, in fact, have port facilities at some point that may be Alaskan port facilities for oil and British Columbian port facilities for gas. Actually, those are built now. So our job is, my job as governor, is to regularly convene and build those strong relationships between the two so we can resolve these issues. Prince Rupert is a dispute over which, whether it's Canadian or American steel, my goodness, that can be resolved with the Premier of British Columbia and the governor of the state of Alaska sitting down, coming up with a solution that will work for both of them, and then going back to their federal governments and saying, this is what we've agreed on, please support it. That isn't being done. So the transboundary issues require a regular transboundary communication, and that must recognize the impact that a development of a mine in Canada might have on the commercial fishing harvest in Alaska. They have to be connected. You cannot do them as though that arbitrary line that we call an international boundary somehow creates two separate ecosystems. It doesn't work that way. But you can have development side by side with protection if you have comprehensive planning. And so best science, the best techniques, the best opportunities, and investment from both sides actually makes that happen. You have to take the lead on it, though, and we have not done that.
Yeah, that's going to be difficult, too, because the British Columbia is trying to just change their environmental assessment plan to not include the tribes.
They can't do that.
So
that's why a governor has to be engaged in the process, because you just sit down and you go, this doesn't work for you, it doesn't work for us. And we have to have a symbiotic relationship here. We have had one for over 100 years. Can't we continue to have a symbiotic relationship where the things you're doing do have impact on us and the things we're doing clearly have impact on you? But if you're not listening to tribal voices, you're not doing your part. And in British Columbia, tribal voices, they are quite powerful. So there's other ways that you can get to influencing the British Columbian government. You know, I chaired co-chaired the Canadian American Committee of the Council on State Governments for a couple of years, and these were exactly the things we talked about. Mm-hmm. It was Canadian American Committee, but I was an Alaskan advocating for Alaska, so we talked about rail, we talked about harbors, we talked about mining, we talked about timber, we talked about water usage, actually, you know, in general, and what can you dam and what can't you dam, and what impact does that have on your and our, you know, your environment and our environment and our economic viability. Those are the things that you would want. I built those relationships. I can't think of any other candidate for office who did. I did in that job, in that perspective.
Yeah. So. Last question. You're also a singer songwriter.
It's true.
And a poet.
Yes.
How has that creative life shaped how you think about leadership and listening?
A good singer-songwriter reads his audience or her audience. And what I mean by that is that I try to write music or poetry that is reflective, as I say on my website, that other website, of the human condition. And the ability to be empathetic, to listen, to feel what other people are thinking or what other people are struggling with informs my music and my poetry. And that well-roundedness allows me to, as a person in politics, not look at it in two dimensions. I look at it in three. You know, it's sort of like, what is going on that has caused you to feel anger in this political moment? And how can I, as opposed to firing up your anger, how can I bring it down a little bit? You know, today in the conversation, there was a person who started that conversation in an angry place. And you were there and you saw it. And that person was not angry at the end. That person was agitated and then was less agitated at the end. And part of that was because I heard him. And I recognized there were things he was very upset about, that some I couldn't change, some I might be able to change, and some I won't change because I don't share the same vision that he had. But being heard is exactly what a singer-songwriter or poet must do. And being heard is a skill set that anyone in politics ought to have. But they don't all, we don't all, I haven't always. But when I finally realized these two things were not separate but connected, it made me a better person and a whole person. And I think that will make me a much better governor. And, you know, Jay Hammond was a poet. And people forget that was something he was very, very proud of. And he would make up lyrics on the spot sometimes. I said lyrics, but poetry on the spot. They could have been lyrical because they were. The bush rap poet, I think, was what he called himself. I'm not comparing myself to him. I'm just saying it's not an abnormal thing. And I'm proud of that part of my life. And I think you might even have some old CDs sitting around this radio station.
And there's a lot over there. Yeah.
But, you know, music is done well by me. I continue to play when I can. I am going to miss an event tomorrow night because I'll be in Petersburg doing other things. But it's been good to me. I still get occasionally $1, maybe $1.20 a month from, you know, Spotify or whatever. But all those albums and that book made money. So not a lot. You know, I'd love to say I've made me rich, but it didn't. But it paid for itself. And that was good enough. Satisfying life.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Yeah. Thank you for having me.
Yeah.